This week on the Donut Box Podcast, we pick up the conversation of overcoming narcissism, gaslighting, and why millennials are so nice when it comes to dealing with narcissism. What's that all about?
Guys, we're too nice. Millennials, we are too nice. We're not going to be the lip noodle generation. We got to talk about this. So let's roll the intro and get into all about narcissism. Hi, I'm Micah.
And I'm Chris.
And we've been friends for over 20 years.
Surprisingly, we haven't killed each other yet. Years ago, we started our own variety show, and it sucked.
Now that we're adults, we decided to give it another try. Like in the movie, life is like a box of donuts. You never know which one's gonna be the next one.
Wait a second, it's chocolates.
Oh, right. Okay, well, let's start the show.
This is the Donut Box Podcast.
So, Micah, it's another week, and we're picking up a conversation that we had a couple weeks ago about narcissism and all that. So it's going to be an interesting ride. I'm ready for it. Thank you to all of our listeners who are listening. If you're listening on Spotify, go check us out on YouTube.
Yeah, absolutely. We are on the D-O-U-G-H-N-U-T Box Podcast, or pod, however you want to type it in. It's going to come up. They're on YouTube. You get to see our gorgeous faces live and in color. I love saying that. I don't know why. Live and in color. But no, if you are listening to us, please feel free to come over to our YouTube page. We really appreciate it. I think I told you last week, but I've actually been going for work. I've been going and getting donuts every Tuesday for some reason. I guess I picked Tuesday to bring donuts into the office, but it is literally... We're on a free flow week, so we're not on our regularly scheduled program where we normally have our old fashioned donut segment, but it is literally called the old fashioned donut, which I think is kind of funny and loops everything in, which their donuts are really, really good, by the way. Everybody in the office is like, where did you get these? And I have to like tell them the exact spot, which I don't know how I found this place, but hey, it works out great. But I am super excited for this week. It is another episode about narcissism. We are on our part two, and we're just going to free flow it. As Chris mentioned in the intro, we're going to go through a myriad of topics, including millennials and, you know, how we've been affected by narcissism, not just millennials, but all people, but, you know, a lot about what we've dealt with here in our generation and what we've done here in our age group here. So, Chris, do you want to kick it off for us?
Yeah. So, narcissism is a broad topic, and it's a term that's used a lot. And we talked in the previous episode about Micah growing up and all that with a narcissist parent. So question I wanted to start off with is about gaslighting. Now, Micah, can you describe gaslighting for our, or what kind of the term means? A lot of people know what it means, but...
Yeah, we'll just go through it. So gaslighting actually came from a movie. The term actually came from a movie. But really, gaslighting is when you are telling somebody, this is the truth, this is how it actually is, but it's really to go on the other person's agenda. What they're trying to get accomplished, they are literally selling you falsities and telling you, hey, this is the truth. And, you know, maybe even making you feel like you're crazy, maybe even making you feel like you're less than, maybe making you feel like your accomplishments are not accomplishments at all. It could be really, again, that is a broad topic as well, but gaslighting is really big, and it's what a lot of narcissists use as their weapon of choice. They're very, we've talked about this in the part one, about how they're very silver-tongued. Now they're very good at gaslighting you and making you feel, again, like you're less than, like your accomplishments are not as good as theirs, things like that.
Yeah, so I've talked about this about with my ex-wife, and I'll talk a little bit more about that, but I'll also talk about how that kind of came into play with faith and like the church that I was a part of and everything. Not where I'm at now. Where I'm at is a very healthy place, but growing up having a background of faith, it's interesting. I've been in places where they mixed gaslighting and faith together. And that's a very dangerous combo. And it's really hard, especially when you're raised to believe people, to trust people. And, you know, you read the Bible and you're like, yeah, I need to trust this person. This person's an authority over me. It's all on me. And I've had a really, not messed up, but it's a really wrong pattern of thinking like, hey, it's up to me to be righteous. It's up to me to do the right thing. And yes, you should take steps in order to do the right thing. But an example of gaslighting is, and so I'll use a funny one, and Micah will has not, he's probably heard of this one, but it'll probably make him think of it another time. So there was this one time, my ex-wife and I, we were sharing a car, and I remember I dropped the car off, and she had it or whatever, and I went to lunch with some of my friends, my coworkers. I remember getting a very angry phone call and was like, hey, like, where did this Christmas tree in the back seat come from? And I was like, what Christmas tree? What are you talking about? And she was like, there's a Christmas tree in the back of the car. Who did you go see? You must be seeing someone and you must have forgot. That must be their Christmas tree. And I was like, dude, I have no idea what you're talking about at all. And I remember it becoming like a very heated argument. And so like in my mind, I'm thinking like, oh, did I pick up a Christmas tree? And a lot of the term of gaslighting, they'll be like, oh, well, maybe you forgot. You've done stuff like this before. And at that time, I had a lot of pressure with just with my job and life and everything going on. And so I was like, maybe I did pick up a Christmas tree and I forgot to tell him, but it's like, oh yeah, you probably forgot to tell me that you picked up a Christmas tree. You've done that before where you picked up things and haven't told me. And that's gaslighting. And I was like,
yeah,
Christmas. And I'm sitting here racking my brain like, and you're like, maybe I did. And you're thinking, where did I pick up this Christmas tree? She was like, well, I didn't pick it up. So you had to be the one to pick it up. And I'm just like, okay, well, maybe I did. And it drives you crazy. It's just mind games. And so I remember a couple of days later being like, it never came up, whatever. And I remember getting out of the argument by being like, well, maybe I did. I forgot to tell you. I don't remember what happened. And a couple of days later, I was like, hey, did we ever figure out where that Christmas tree came from? I never even saw the Christmas tree at this point. She was like, oh yeah, I figured out where it was came from. And I was like, well, where did it come from? She was just like, don't worry about it. And I was like, okay, like, and she never apologized for accusing me, like nothing. And I was just kind of like, bro.
And chances are there probably wasn't a Christmas tree. And chances are there probably wasn't even a Christmas tree. But continue.
It was probably like, again, we talked about that tactic of, hey, they're going to try to see what else they can get out of you. And I remember there was also this one time, like, and Micah remembers this, there was this one time where there was this, it was like mascara or lipstick that I was like, hey, here's your mascara or lipstick. Like, it was in my truck. Like, you're the only girl that's been in my truck. And so he was like, well, that's not my mascara. That's not my lipstick. Who's that from? Are you seeing somebody? Are you cheating on me? And I was like, no, like, you have been literally the only person in my truck. I was like, Micah's been in my truck, but he don't wear mascara. I was like, so that has to be. She was like, well, that must be from some other girl. Like, you're going to see this and that. And I was like, racking my brain. I was like, I remember I gave Adam the keys to my truck and had him go take it to the dumpster, the boxes to the dumpster. So I was like, maybe he brought somebody with him. And so in my mind, I'm like, because she was not like, it was going on like 30 minutes of this. And I was just like, okay, well, I remember giving it to my friend Adam, the keys to my friend Adam, and maybe he brought another girl in there. And like, maybe that's what happened. Like, that's probably what happened. And so like, I just made up all these things to get out of the cover. That's not what happened. But in my mind, I'm like, who could have been in my car? And like, that was another example where it was like, do you remember that?
Yeah, I do remember that. That was a whole crazy time. And it reminds me of going back to my childhood, a very prime example of that as well. I remember being around the dinner table, and I didn't catch on to this for years. But I did get into a lot of trouble as a kid in school and things like that. And so what would end up happening was my father would be sitting at one end of the table, you know, at the head of the table, and he'd be sitting there eating, and he wouldn't even look up from his plate, and he would go, you know, your teacher called me and she told me what you did, so you might as well tell me what's going on. And typically being in trouble, like, you would rack your brain about like every little thing. I remember one example, and this is kind of a funny example, but like, I remember, now granted, we were in the third grade, so please don't take this out of context, but we literally had like a peeing contest in the bathroom of like who could like stand way back and like hit it in the urinal. And so like, we didn't get in trouble, and I didn't think we got caught for that, but it'd be things like that. And you'd like rack your brain about that and go, well, I guess they found out somehow, right? Like, I guess the teacher found out somehow And then they called my parents. I didn't even know that she knew. So how did he know? And then all of a sudden you're admitting it. And now you're like in deep, deep trouble. So yeah, that's, I totally get what you're saying. That,
yeah.
That it happens.
And so that was a consistent theme a lot of times. And so for me, I would just not say anything. I really suppressed like who I was as a person, because the whole goal was just make this person happy. Don't get into a fight, like walking
on
eggshells. And it was always like, and I remember like a lot of times she'd be like, well, I have to always walk on eggshells with you. And she knew like the history of a relationship with my dad and everything. It wasn't great. And my dad, in an unhealthy season of his life, he would get mad very, very quickly. And I'm not trying to talk bad about my dad, but that just happened. He was an unhealthy season of his life. I remember having to walk around eggshells with him. And I remember being like, I don't ever want to put anybody in that situation. My wife, my kids, I don't want them to ever feel like they have to walk on eggshells with me. She'd be like, oh, well, you're just like your dad. Like, and like, she knew that was like a big fear. Yeah. Like knew how to use that. That was a big fear of mine, was like, I don't want to be like that. I don't want to be like how my dad was when he was unhealthy. And she was just like, yeah, you're just like your dad. I have to walk around eggshells with you. Your anger is out of control. Now, did I have a temper like when I was early/late teenager? Yeah. But like at that point in my life, my temper wasn't that bad. Like I wouldn't yell, I wouldn't scream, I wouldn't throw things, but like she knew how to push my buttons. It was almost like, okay, I'm going to poke the dog. And then when the dog snaps, it's like, see, the dog's just bad.
See, you proved my point. This is what I'm talking about right here. And then that's, you know, the unforgivable sin. And that's the thing that will come up for months and months and months and months and months. Like you could be on your best behavior for the rest of the time. You know, it's funny because narcissists, they tell you exactly sometimes their roadmap and what's going on. My father did that as well. And I remember one of the things that he said was, you can do 99 things right, but people will always remember the one that you did wrong. Come to find out later on in life, that's not necessarily true, that you can do most things right. And if you make one mistake, people understand that you make mistakes, or hey, they understand that you're haven't eaten anything all day or you're tired or whatever. And most of the time people will understand that, but it's typically those narcissists that will use that against you. Those are the people who remember the one out of the 99.
Yep. And that's exactly right, where they'd be like, and she would, because I've told you guys, there was a period of my time where I was like, I believed in God, but I wasn't going to church. I wasn't like reading I wasn't actively like following Christ. And she would always go back, see, you're not being a man of God. Like you're going back to the way you used to, this and that. Like I'm in here for a man of God. Like that's why I want to, and I'm not going to put up with that. And I just was like, okay, I'm so sorry. I don't want to be that way. Like I'm trying to actively like be better. You know what I mean? And so like, I'd be like, oh man, like I'm a horrible person. She would even she'd be like, oh yeah, I can tell how your mood is by the color of your eyes. Like she used to say that. And she'd be like, oh yeah, your eyes are really like blue. So like, you know, I can tell like you've been spending time with God because your eyes are light blue, like after you spend time with God. Bro, like it was, and I believed it. Yeah. Like it's that crazy. Like I believed it. She was like, oh, like your eyes are dark brown. I can tell like you haven't been spending time or you're angry right now. And I'm like, no, I'm not angry. Like this. And I believed it. I was like, well, if I'm showing some signs, maybe like, and I remember there was this one time where this was kind of in the season where like we were kind of on again, off again, like dating. And I remember I went to her concert one time. And like, I showed up in like nice, you know, slacks and nice shirt. Now, did I look like I was going to my court date because the shirt didn't fit me? Yeah. But I was working overnights at the time. And so like, I had maybe slept like 2 hours. But I remember her being like, yeah, you know, my family said they think you're all on drugs because you just look rough when you walked in there. And I was like, well. And at that point, I was like trying to prove myself like, no, I'm a good Christian man, like this and that, like. I would drop everything like at her call, just because I wanted to make her happy. And she'd be like, see, like, if you were really a godly man, like, you'd be loving me and giving me attention, because the Bible says, like, a good godly man, you know, loves and honors his wife. And she would, I think I told you this in the last episode, but she would have text messages that I sent her, like, because at that time, like, all I did was work overnight. So I had a lot of time, like, just pray and, like, spend time with God. Like, I didn't have friends. And so that's what I would do. I would read my Bible and pray for, like, 2 hours every day. But then, like, once I got out of work, or like got a different job and I started getting busier, like, I didn't have, like, I still read my Bible, but I didn't just do it for like 2 or 3 hours a day, because I didn't have the time. And I remember she would text me like text messages that I had sent her during that time that I was praying and reading my Bible. She's like, I miss this man of God. I miss when you were trying to pursue me. Like, you're not really in it. Like, you're not trying and this and that. But like, I would try to do, it was never good enough. Like, anything I would try to do, like, even if she liked me to dress a certain way, I would do that. But like, if I didn't do things up to her, the standard felt like it was always a moving target. And we've
always changing.
In some of our drives, do you kind of want to talk about how you, like, with narcissism, the standard to get their approval is always like changing. It's always a moving target.
Yeah. And so the prime example that I have, so do you remember being in health class? And maybe they didn't tell you this in health class, but I remember being in middle school and going through the health class and doing the cheesy 90s, you know, VHS where they're talking about drugs and they're talking about don't do drugs and, you know, weed's a gateway drug and all this other stuff, right? But what the biggest message was, and I remember this very vividly, is they had this like line, right? And they're like, yeah, the first time you get high, it's like a big peak, but eventually it only gets like up to the line and you can never get back to the line. And you're always trying to get back to the line of feeling good. It's the same thing. It's almost like you're chasing that line of, at first, yes, those narcissists will give you, hey, you're doing a great job. Hey, you're doing everything you're supposed to be doing, you know, and you believe them because seemingly they're successful people. They're very good at making themselves look successful in a certain type of way. And so, and I can speak on Chris's example because I knew the situation as well. This young lady really, she was a very prominent member of the church. She was teaching. She was in Sunday school. So from all looks and manners, and she sung. I mean, she sung on stage for certain things. And so from all manners and from all angles that you can look at this, you would think, okay, well, she would know because she's a very godly person herself. So she knows the standard, right? And so a lot of times they will make it seem like, see, I know the standard because look at what I'm doing. You're not up to that standard. You used to be when it first started, but what happened to you? And that is one of the biggest hooks that happen. And so you're always constantly trying to measure yourself back to that standard. And it is a roller coaster of a ride. And sometimes you'll get close, or you'll feel like, hey, I'm getting close to making that person happy, or, you know, and typically it'll be, how do I put this? They're not exactly happy, but they're satisfied with your work, if that makes sense. Like, they're not happy with you, but it's like, that'll do, donkey. That'll do, donkey. Like, right. I don't know.
I feel like also, too, at the beginning, and this is where I'm going to, back to your point, at the beginning, they love bomb you to the nth degree.
Absolutely.
And as soon as you do something they don't like, it's like, okay, now you got to get, now that they have the control over you, and they're,
and
like,
they know they do. Once they know they have it.
And now it's you working to get back into their good graces. But what you have to do to get back into their good graces, because most of the time people, and we're talking, when we say narcissist, we're talking about full blown narcissism.
Full blown narcissism.
Textbook definition.
Because going back to the last episode, I think I said it or you said it. Everybody has some sort of narcissistic tendencies. You can point out anything. And really and truly, what narcissism at its core is extreme selfishness is what it is. And so everybody's got selfish tendencies. That's a human nature. That's a human trait. You have to fight against that sort of thing. But when we're talking about narcissists, we are talking about people to where they don't have any concept of anybody else around them besides the people that are around them are tools to be used. That's all that they are. They don't have the same sort of understanding that most people have. If you have a conscience, and what I mean by that is if you're watching this and go, man, maybe I'm a narcissist because of some of the ways I'm thinking, I think the ultimate test is, one, if you're thinking that, you're not a narcissist because you care. But two, if you're really looking at things and you say, oh, I'm thinking about my grandma, right? And it's like, man, I love my grandma just because she's my grandma and we had all these wonderful, great times and things like that. You're not a narcissist.
Yep.
Narcissists think about grandma and go, well, she hasn't done this and this and this and this for me lately. That's how a narcissist thinks.
The inheritance that I'm trying to get.
Or, yes, it's always the plan of, okay, how can I get something from them? Or they haven't been giving me what I'm looking for lately. That's the thought process.
Well, what I was going to say with narcissism and full-blown textbook narcissists, everything for them is big, grandiose. So you have to make these big, grandiose gestures. And a lot of times, I'm not saying all charismatic people are narcissists. That's what I'm saying. But a lot of times they are charismatic and they are these big personalities. So for you to do something to get into their good graces, it has to be over the top, like really big over the top. And again, that's why a lot of narcissists have these big charismatic personalities, because they're trying to draw all the attention in the room onto them. I mean, I think about like your paternal unit. He had these stages where he would, whether it was the motorcycle phase, whatever, but it was always, hey, look at me because I'm standing out. I'm different. It wasn't a, hey, I'm going to be different. It's a, hey, like, I'm going to be the one to draw all the attention in the room.
Now, this one, I have an example of that from my paternal unit. And the biggest thing, I remember being at Thanksgiving one year. We went out to Birmingham, Alabama, and we went with my mother's family out there, which he already didn't have a great relationship and they didn't really care for him. But one of the things that he did, one, because he wanted to show how much of a big shot he was, he's like, I'm going to put together Thanksgiving this year. And these people are very traditional. Like, we always have Thanksgiving at the same place. We always have the same things. And he said, I'm going to bring a smoker and we're going to do Cornish game hens. And like, this is the thing. And we're making it happen this year. And so they said, sure, why not? Right. And I remember I was not given a time of when Thanksgiving dinner was going to happen. And so this place that we were staying at had a lot of fishing. It was a big fishing place. And so I was out fishing. Well, one of the things is it was out in the middle of nowhere. So there was no cell reception. Like, I had a basic flip phone, but there wasn't any cell reception out there. And so apparently tried to call. And so finally I kind of got the inclination of like, yeah, maybe I should start walking back. Like, it's probably about time. So I started walking back, and then phone call comes in. Where are you at? What are you doing? Why have you been taking so long? And the biggest thing about it wasn't just that. The grandiose gesture was, if you want me to not be bad and embarrass you in front of everybody, you need to be running back here. I better see you running as fast as you can back to this camp. And that was the whole thing. Was It wasn't about me being late. It wasn't about the cell phone reception. It wasn't about anything like that. It was to show I've got the control of my kid. You run. And I did. I ran as fast as I could back, because I knew that if I did not, I was going to be made the thing of. But what I didn't understand at the time was I was already being made the pariah because I'm the one having to sprint back. Don't think the family wasn't like, why was he sprinting back here? You know, that's weird, right? Why are you sprinting? So, but at the same time, that was the whole thing, was like, if you want to get back in my good graces, you better sprint back here. You better sprint back here and show me that you want to get back into my good grace. That's what that was. You have to make that gesture.
Yeah. So kind of shifting a little bit, because Micah and I, in different seasons of our life, we've dealt with narcissists and jobs and just everything. But like, I want to talk about narcissism and how when you have a full-blown narcissist, like in a spiritual leadership role, like, it's never good, because then they take and twist the Bible and it's really like really not good. They use the Bible as a weapon. And the Bible says that scripture is profitable for teaching, for correction, for encouraging, all that. And there is a part of, hey, yes, if you read the Bible and realize, you know, you're not doing right, like, yeah, it should correct you, right? But
yeah, absolutely.
So I'm going to use examples of this in various stages of my life, but not now because I'm in a very healthy place.
God.
Spiritually, yeah. Thank the Lord. But one of the things that I heard was, and it wasn't spoken to me, but anytime someone wanted to leave the church or they were like, hey, I'm going to go to another church and I want to check this out. It wasn't, hey, I'm stopping church completely. It was, hey, I just want to go to another church. It was, well, you know, the enemy wants you to pull up your roots. And so how can you have covering in your life if you're not spiritually grounded and this and that? And it's kind of like, okay, but they're just wanting to go check out another church. Like, they're not necessarily said they're leaving. They just feel like it's time to move on. And that was used to like beat people up. Another one that I heard was, and I hated this, and I still hate this to this day. Our church is like a restaurant. We can only serve those that come. And so it was basically like if anybody needed any assistance, and I get it, they were a smaller church, so they didn't have as much resources. But if anybody asked for assistance, it was like, well, when was the last time they were here in church? How much are they tithing? Are they even tithing? Are they plugged in? And I'm kind of like, okay, like I understand that from an accountability standpoint, like everyone has a sob story, but like someone reaches out to you and you know genuinely that they need help. I saw people turn other people away because they were like, well, they're not part of our church, so we're not going to help them. It was almost like a click. I'm not going to use the word cult, yeah. But click. And so I'm kind of like, wow, like that's not good. I had one pastor tell me, because you're not going to our church and you're choosing to go to a different church, I'm not your pastor anymore, so I can't help you with spiritual guidance. I can't help you with any counseling that you need, none of that. So you let that pastor take care of you. And I was kind of like, man, like that made me feel horrible as a human.
And let me ask you this, and I already know your answer for this, but you know, personally, how I feel about it is it's almost like first responders or doctors or things like that. It's like, it doesn't matter if you're off duty. It doesn't matter if you're outside your room. It doesn't matter if you're on vacation and you see somebody that needs help. It's your responsibility. You know, in some professions, you take an oath that, hey, anytime I see somebody who's in health, you know, doctors, nurses, things like that, I'm going to help them. I feel like pastoral, you know, leadership, care, that sort of thing, even associate pastors are in that same role of, it doesn't matter if they're going to your church or not. If you see somebody who's in need, yeah, I mean,
yeah.
I feel like you feel the same way, but do you feel any further about that?
Yeah, I think you're right. If you need prayer, I don't care who you are, I'm going to pray for you. And I had this situation happen a couple of weeks ago. But I was kind of like, hey, with a pastor, I was like, hey, I really need to talk about some stuff. And they were like, okay, let me look at my time today. And they moved. They didn't have to move their schedule, but I was like, hey, don't worry about it. Like, we could talk about it next week. It's like, no, if it's important to you, like, I'm going to make time for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I understand different pastors who are like, well, if you don't come to my congregation, I can't help you out. I mean, I understand there are people that are trying to hustle the system and all that stuff. I've met people that way. But if you know someone is legitimate and you feel in your heart that they're legitimate, you know, it was almost like there's a problem with you if you're not coming to our church, like our specific church on this street at this time. Like, we're all the body of Christ. And we talked about this probably the last time we did the episode, but even with that manager at Boot Corral, when I told him, I felt in my life like I needed to leave that place because it was not good for me spiritually. Like being around, sometimes you can be around influences and you're fine, but those people at that time of my life, they were just not good influences, and I needed to like leave and not work there anymore just because it was not helping me in my walk with Christ. And I remember like telling him that, and he was like, if Jesus were here, he'd come down here and slap you in the face and tell you you're making a mistake and telling you how stupid you are and how dumb you are for doing this and da 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 da. And I'm kind of like, that's gaslighting in of itself. But do you have any other examples of like, and I'm not trying to like talk bad about like Christianity or anything, but do you have any examples of how you had to overcome like narcissism in faith or gaslighting in faith to help kind of with you develop some good, healthy thought patterns?
So I hate to go back to my paternal, you know, I really do, but he is such a good example. Like, the guy is just such a good example. So, and you were part of this too for a little bit. If you've heard some of our other episodes, there was actually a point, and it was because of his ex-wife, part of it, and some other things, and a relationship, a narcissistic relationship that I was in, that really split us apart for a time there. But we started going to this particular church, and it was a small church, and you know exactly where I'm going. I saw the smile on your face. So we started going to this small church, and it was a four-square church, if you've ever heard of them. One of the subsects, really close to Pentecostal, they come out of the Azusa Street Revivals, if you've ever heard of that. But anyways, so we get into there, and from the very beginning, I mean, the guy called himself Chancellor Palpatine. That's what he called himself, because he was like, okay, I'm basically going to circumvent the system and get into the leadership of this place. And at first, here's the hard part for me, going back to your question. So when you've 100% bought into a narcissist, when you've bought into the ideas that they've had, everybody is wrong but them. Everybody is wrong but them. So going into the place, he was like the senior pastor. He's a weak person with no spine, which was the truth. He was letting people run all over the church. But still, that is your senior pastor. That is your senior leader. Regardless of what it is, there should be a level of respect there. Even if that's what's going on, you should be there to help, not hinder. But he saw an opportunity. The other thing was, there was several other members of the church. There was a youth pastor and his wife, who they were narcissists as well, which was kind of interesting. And that was his first threat. That was the first threat that he took place. And he identified that as, they have control of this place. I need to get them out first in order to take control of this place. And so what he had bought into, and don't get me wrong, they were terrible people as well. And they were using a lot to their advantage. They were living in a parsonage for free. Like, they were doing all sorts of stuff that was just extremely, and I'm not saying living in a parsonage is ungodly, but when they wouldn't hardly work. And then the messages that they were giving were always very, that's great, give us money. That's great, give us money. It was very agenda focused. They had their own little scheme going on, and they were sucking the place dry. Meanwhile, the senior pastor was having to drive a bus and was taking no paycheck because they were hemorrhaging money like crazy. And he was being overly nice, right? He was being overly nice because he felt like that's what a pastor should do. He should give to everybody else, and sometimes he doesn't get it. In some situations, that is absolutely true. But in this case, they were taking extreme advantage of him. And so, you know, it was very easy to fall into the trap, especially when you're bought into a narcissist. It's like, see, everybody else is the problem. All these people are the problem. They are doing ungodly things. I need to come in here and clean house. So you're sitting here going, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Somebody needs to come in here and clean house. But at the same time, what ended up happening when he got to the top of things? Like, because it was just a few, it seemed like a few weeks. I don't think it was longer than that. But at the same time, they gave him keys to the church. He became a deacon. He was on the board. It was like, they barely knew this guy. We barely were a part of this church. And they're just like, here, have the reins this whole entire thing. And it was because he was so charismatic. And the first thing he did was, he was like, kick those people, the youth pastor and his wife, out of the parsonage, kick them out. They're gone. And he made it happen. Like, get out. After that, there were several other people at the church. He was like, out, you're done, get out. And so he changed the entire dynamic of the church only to get his gain. And then when he got to the top, basically, he got bored. And he's like, okay, I'm here. That's great. And then left. And left that place. I don't know how he left the place, because I stopped going to church because I had my own problems at that point as well with things. But it was very, very, going back to your point, it's easy when you're bought into that everybody else is the problem. And so for a long time, that was the problem. And so when it came to my view of the church, I viewed everybody to be the problem. I viewed everybody, from the senior pastor, whether they were too strict, whether they were too loose, whether they were too, you know, whether they had assistant pastors who weren't great, whether they had, I mean, no church is going to be perfect. And granted, that place had a lot of problems comparative to most, but I had to change my thought process, and I'm still having to change my thought process because I am still not in a perfect place, and I am still trying to find my perfect church, or not my perfect church, but the church that I want to be a part of, because I sit there and I nitpick the dog out of everything that people do because I'm looking for holes and flaws, because that's all that he did. He looked for the holes and the flaws and everything that people did. And for somebody like me, I take that not as holes and flaws of here's what I can exploit like he did, but I take it as holes and flaws of maybe this is a question of spirituality and maybe something is wrong with their spirit and maybe they're not about this for the right reasons, because that was what was sold to me for so long of these people aren't here for the right reasons and here's why.
Yeah, I think that's really good. And kind of swinging back on the other end and caution, if we have any pastors or church leadership listening, I feel like there are narcissists that churches are an easy target for them because people are so trusting, because as Christians, we believe the best about everyone, right? And so there are narcissists that try to infiltrate church leadership. And so if you're a pastor, just be careful who is in your inner circle. I've known people that the only reason why they tried to get close to me was try to mine information about what was going on, or trying to like get an angle and get an in and get a trust. And it's kind of like, okay, now that I have the 2020 vision, I can see what they're doing, but that is an easy place. And so what I wanted to ask you, kind of a follow-up to your question, and this is a long way to get to the question, but because I was in the same boat with you, with your paternal unit, I was like, I looked up to him because I was like, you know what? He doesn't take any nonsense. If he wants something done, he just goes and get it. And I still have this, I'm a very mild like person. It's like, oh yeah, like I want to be able to be like, no, you're a buffoon. Like I'm not dealing with any buffoonery. Like I'm going to cut that mess. Do you think that's why like me and you kind of like not idolize him, but looked up to him in that way? Or maybe it was easy for us to maybe miss the signs.
I think it was easy to miss the signs because one, he was very charismatic. And again, we go back to the fact that a lot of these people are very, very charismatic people. I mean, hey, even your ex-wife, bringing her back up, she was a very charismatic person. When I first met her, until she identified me as a threat against you, like, I mean, I didn't think anything was wrong. I thought that she was a totally normal, good Christian lady. Like, I didn't think anything and like, she's super involved. The kids loved her. She sang on stage. The staff loved her. Like, I mean, what's wrong? What's wrong with? And so I think what's hard is people, going back to what you were saying about people being trusting, and even with pastors listening and things like that, I think one thing that is mistaken when it comes to Christianity, especially, is we are called to be Christ-like, right? That is the whole entire point. And one thing that we miss about Christ, yes, he was for the meek. Yes, he was for the mild. And he did have those moments. And the majority of the time, he was the shepherd-type personality to where he was very loving and caring. But this was the same guy who also flipped tables when things were not right at the same time. And I think we forget that part about him, because when people come about that, and the gift of discernment that he had, I mean, of course, he had all the gifts to the best of their abilities, but I feel like a lot of people miss that gift of discernment of looking through the rose-colored lenses of these people and looking deeper, because it's like, just because they look good on the outside doesn't mean that they are necessarily for your best interest and for what is right. And so I think what we've seen through this entire time, not just with the Christianity part of it, but just dealing with narcissists in particular, is seeing through the actual 2020, both hindsight and real time. If there is anything that I am very, very grateful for with going through a lot of what we've gone through with narcissism, you and I both have a very good gift of, we can read people and go, oh man, that guy right there, not necessarily what we want, or that gal right there, ooh, we need to watch for them because they got something about them. And sometimes it's not even known things. It's a gut feeling. Sometimes it's like, oh my gosh, okay, something's going on with that person. They've given me nothing to go off of. And I feel kind of weird about that. But at the same time, there is something about that person that maybe I should look out for. And it's not again, that's that gift of discernment. It's not necessarily I don't trust them and I'm not going to give them a fair shot, but it's I'm going to keep my eye out and I'm going to make sure that this is not what I think it is. And hopefully my gut is wrong, because sometimes it is, but the majority of the time it's right. It's seeing those things. Hopefully that answered your question a little bit. I know we kind of went in depth. But
I was going to talk about that as well. Like, yeah, there are some people I'm like, I don't know what it is, but something's off. And I can't tell you exactly what it is, but something's off. And so, like you said, I'm thankful that the Lord allowed us to go through that. And now it's a little bit easier to identify. So kind of switching gears a little bit and kind of going to what we talked about, the introduction. Why do you think millennials are so nice when it comes to narcissism and so trusting? Like, what do you think it is? Because I've noticed that a lot of us millennials, we're very like apologetic, very trusting. Like, I don't know what it is.
I mean, we could be at the coffee shop and somebody could mess up our order, and for some reason we end up apologizing to them for making the mistake. I think a lot of this, so narcissism at its core, and I've done some research. Now, I'm not claiming to be an expert on narcissism and things like that, but I have gone through therapy and talked to a therapist about it, and then also done my own research about narcissism. You know, narcissism, some people are born with narcissism. It is a true blue mental disorder that some people are born with. But a lot of times it is born out of trauma. A lot of times it is because of the fact that they have been oppressed so far into life, you know, and a lot of the examples that we've seen in our own life have come from religion, have come from, and I'm not saying, so hear me, Christianity and religion are two different things. Believing in Christ and living for Christ is different than an organized religion. And what I mean by that is the organized religion has a rules and subsects of rules that might not necessarily align with what is being Christ-like. Again, there is an agenda with some of these, with these religions that are very, very in-depth and are very easy to be exploited to the point where people are oppressed. People are straight up oppressed to where they don't have control for a long time. And that's what ends up happening. A lot of it has to do with control. A lot of it is, hey, I was bullied for years. I was a part of a religion that I couldn't do hardly anything. I had to dress a certain type of way. I had to be this person who I actually was not. And so what ends up happening is there's a series of choices. And those choices end up happening to where you say, okay, I'm either going to subject others like this, or I'm going to take control of my own life, or I'm going to choose to not have other people go through this as well. And narcissists typically choose the, listen, I've been out of control and I have, you know, I've even seen a lot of people come out of the military with narcissism because they've been oppressed for years and years and years. And I mean, even the guys who retired, right? They've been under a rule for 20 years. You can't, you have to shave all the time. You have to do all this stuff. And I'm not saying it's those little things, but inherently, we all want control of our life. That's the whole struggle that we have. That is one of the things of nature that we want. We want to have a certain level of control. And so if you have none, some people choose, well, I'm going to take control wherever I can, and I'm going to make sure that I have the control, and I'm going to make sure that it doesn't happen to me again, to where I don't have the control. And that's where a lot of narcissism is bred. Now, going back to your question, what I think has happened a lot, you go back to our previous generations, the baby boomers, Gen X, things like that, not just because of war. I know that there was a lot of restrictions because of wartime. I go back to the military. A lot of people are in the military and things like that. But you talk about the baby boomers. So many soldiers came back from World War II. They saw so many things, right? And they did not have control of their lives. They had so many problems. And then, so what happened with their kids? They told their kids, you got to be tough. You got to be tough. Don't cry about nothing. That was a lot of what those generations were taught. You don't cry about nothing. Even if you feel these things, you don't talk about it. You repress these things, right? And so what I think ended up happening You have baby boomers, then you go to Gen X. Gen X got the trickle-down effect of that. And so then when it comes down all the way down the line, I feel like just like anything else in life, the pendulum starts to swing the other way. People start seeing, okay, well, maybe that's not the right thing, right? Maybe we shouldn't be so hard. Maybe we shouldn't be so cold. We can feel our emotions because we're human, and that's what we're supposed to do. So we get to the millennial side of things, and we're starting to consciously think about these things, and it's being more and more accepted to understand these things. But yet we have these generations before us who have a larger number of narcissists because they've gone through so much trauma, where now we're dealing with these people over and over and over. And even if they're not narcissists, let's be real. The previous generations are harder than we are. They're a lot colder than we are. And so I think a lot of that has to, you know, our parents, our grandparents, how many times have you heard, oh man, you cry too much. Y'all just cry too much. All you millennials, boo-hoo-hoo, y'all cry too much. I heard that so much in my childhood from my grandparents, from my parents. It's just like, all y'all just cry. Y'all just have this. It's like, no, we're just seeing how things don't have to be. You know, I didn't understand this for years. I know I'm full of analogies today. But when I was in high school, there was a long-standing tradition in our high school. And it's really dumb now that I think about it. But when I was a freshman, and they would always call the freshmen into the gym for assemblies, and it's not Texas, so they don't have pep rallies all the time. They would have a fall pep rally for fall sports, and then they would have a spring pep rally for spring sports. So they only had the two pep rallies a year. But they would call you by grade level. So the seniors would go first, the juniors, the sophomores, and freshmen would go last. And the whole thing was, when the freshmen would march in, everybody would yell, "Go home, freshmen." Don't know why. But the other part of that tradition was you got to throw things at the freshmen. So, I mean, all sorts of stuff. People would make bags of, like, just the nastiest, like, peanut butter and just all this nasty stuff from lunch, and they're throwing it at us. And yeah, I got hit with like batteries and like all sorts of crap, right? And so I remember a few years go by, and what was the thought process? I get to be a sophomore, and I'm like, oh yeah, the freshman, like, we get to go do the go home freshman thing. What are you going to throw at the freshman, right? And then junior year rolls around, it's like, oh yeah, what are we going to throw at the freshman? And I remember there was a guy who, I mean, he became very unpopular at school, but he wrote an article in the school newspaper about how that really, really hurts people, and how, because we had an uptick, we had a few kids, we had one kid who tried to commit suicide, and then we had two kids who actually did. I'm not saying it was because of the go-home freshman thing, but it was like, we're already under a lot, and then now we have to deal with this, what the heck? And for a long time, I thought, well, that's just tradition for tradition's sake. We might as well, you know, we might as well do that. But that's the attitude. You know what I mean? That's the attitude that I feel like millennials have broken for a lot of it is, you had the baby boomers, you had the Gen X, you had these folks who are saying, you know what, suck it up, because we had to suck it up. And millennials finally got to the point where it's like, no, we don't have to just suck it up. We can talk about this. We can go to therapy. Because think about it, our generation before that, I even remember when I was a kid, it's like, don't go to therapy. That means you're crazy. And now it's like, that's a normal, common thing. Like, that's been broken down for, and there are certain classes of people who it was like, they were not supported. They were not, and now it's like, that's no big deal. And I feel like over time that pendulum has swung to where it's like, no, we don't have to do those things. We don't have to be repressed. We don't have to be cold-hearted. And so I think to some standard, it's swung all the way to the other direction to where it's like, listen, we got treated poorly, so we're not going to treat people poorly. Because how many, and I'm talking, I know there's probably Gen Xers and, you know, baby boomers and y'all that are listening to this, but y'all be mean up in the Starbucks when somebody gets y'all's order wrong. And y'all be mean up in the stores when y'all don't have things. And we've seen that. And we've gotten to the point where it's like, not only am I not going to treat these people like that, and most of the time we've been those people in the retail getting yelled at by the baby boomers, right? So we're not going to subject people to that. And I think that's where it's gotten, is we're not going to subject people to that. But I think we can be too nice to where it's like people are wronging us and we're still like, okay, well, it just is what it is. And so I think that there's got to be a balance. But I think because we were the trendsetters and because we were the chain breakers, it's kind of gone way off to this direction. I think that's why we're so nice.
I think, too, it's also our generation, like you said, is the first to identify, hey, this is kind of a problem. Now, Gen Zers, they are like, yeah, they already know now it's a problem because millennials have led the way. And Gen Z is like, yeah, I'm not putting up with that. Like, I'm going to speak out against it, this and that. But also, too, if you think about it, baby boomers are still raising their kids. Hey, you respect authority. You don't talk back, this and that. Gen Xers are now raising millennials. Hey, you don't talk back. And so we're still under the mindset, hey, you don't talk back to someone that's in authority. And so I think that's also, too, where it's like, hey, I know from me, it's like, hey, if there's a narcissist that's treating people this way, who's going to be the one to speak? It's probably going to be a Gen Z person who's going to be like, hey, this ain't cool at all. But millennials, we're so afraid of like, yeah, we're still going to lose our jobs because who's in power now? The Gen Xers and some baby boomers, but not as many.
Baby boomers, a lot of baby boomers have more retired at this point. I feel like there's a ton that's retired. But no, you're right. I think there's a lot of it that they still control a lot of the positions of leadership. And there is that stigma out there about our generation, about especially Gen Z too, now that they're entering the workforce in number, that it's like, you guys just don't know how to work and you guys don't know how to do it. And a lot of them take kind of the pushback as, oh, well, you guys just don't want to work. You guys don't want to do what you need to do. And sometimes that's not the case. Now, don't get me wrong, there is some laziness aspect to it, but that's with every generation. If you look at every generation, there has always been a bit of laziness. So,
yeah, and it's also, too, one of my pieces of advice, you cannot reason or counsel a narcissist. So if you go up to them and say, oh, yeah, like, in this meeting you came across this way, their response is going to be like, oh, well, I came across this way because you did this or they did. It's never taking accountability. And so I think also millennials, too, we're still trying to figure out, we're still trying to recognize signs of, is this narcissism? Because a lot of us are like, hold on. Now, a lot of those millennials are now going to therapy and we are starting to learn like, hey, how do we do this? But also, too, where I think, like you said, the pendulum is swung the other way. When we come about it, we don't want to be too confrontational because we know how that feels. And so my question to you is, if you are in a situation where you realize you're being gaslighted by a narcissist, in the middle of that argument, what would you say are some tools that you can use to help, like, I don't know, like mental judo or verbal judo or what have you?
So what I've noticed over time, and this is, like you said, it's hard because we're all trying to figure this out. There's no perfect way to do this because I also feel like narcissist to narcissist, they're all different. It's not like there is one. So sure, there are some signs and there are some bona fide, here's what they do. But each one of them has had life experiences that have taught them, hey, here's how I can pivot from that. And now make this person to be the bad guy, or it might even not even be you. It could be Susan Q in accounting that they can make look bad. You know, it could be anybody else that they can do. But going back to your question, there are some situations where, just like you've heard before, it's like a bully situation. If you stand up to them, a lot of times that diffuses them to where, and I'm not talking about stand up to them and be like, hey, man, you're a piece of crap. Because going back to what Chris was talking about with his ex-wife, they're going to go, see, this is what I'm talking about. This is the stuff, and they will use that against you. You have to be very, very tactful. And again, that's where it's like situation by situation, it's hard. But at the same time, if you're like, listen, man, I'm not going to take this crap. I'm on to your game, and here's how. I know that you're trying to gaslight me because of this, this, and this. And even if they're coming back at you and be like, you have to almost be nonchalant about it. Be like, whatever, man. Listen, I'm telling you, I know I'm on to you. I know what's going on. I can tell what's going on. I can see right through your crap. I'm not playing your game. You can point back at me all you want, but I know exactly what you're doing. That just diffuses them because they're going, oh, what do I do now? Because they're on to me. And they might, but see, here's where it's hard, because now they know they can't get anywhere with you. So they're going to go to everybody else and try to get somewhere with them. So you have to also be prepared with that. But again, what I've noticed over time is even if they go to other people and say, you know, Micah's doing this and he's doing that, and they're trying to sully you, if you have a good character, if you have a good name, all you have to do is go, really, Susie from accounting, you really think that I'm doing that? Or Aunt so-and-so, you really think that I'm doing that? Or Grandma, you think I'm really doing that? Like, look at me. Come on. You really think that that's going on? Because what they're counting on is they're counting on you to come back with anger or shock. They're expecting you to be like, oh my God, I can't believe that you told somebody else. And so it's just like, well, that guy's a piece of crap. And then that proves their point. It proves their point. So you have to just go, listen, really? Do you think that's what's going on? And most of the time people are like, well, no, because there's, and you go through the evidence and they're like, well, no, there's no evidence that you're actually doing that. And it's like, come on, seriously? It's not true. And if you just play it off very nonchalantly and just go with the facts, then most of the time people will go, well, yeah, okay, I don't know why he would say that about you then. It's like, I don't know either. But that's the other thing, too, is you can't directly call a lot of these people narcissists to other people because, again, they will use that point and be like, well, he's the narcissist. See, he's being the narcissist, pointing the finger at everybody else. And it's like, wait a second. You pointed the finger at me first, pal. Okay.
One thing I think will help, and some narcissists you just can't get away from because they're your boss or you work with them. I think what you need to do is, number one, be mentally prepared before you have any conversations with them and know, hey, this person is not out for my best interest. Anything I say in here could be twisted, and have documentation. Documentation, evidence,
huge.
Anything you can have, because if they say, oh, yeah, they said this and this and that. Oh, really? I have this email that says otherwise. Yeah. And that, like, again, narcissists don't like that. But if you can tell other people, like Micah was saying, the facts and say, no, here are the facts, this, this, and this. I remember I had a conversation with a guy and he kind of tried to gaslight me. And it was really a, hey, what you're doing and these policies and procedures are unacceptable. And I said that, hey, that's not going to work, man. That's unacceptable. And it turned into a, wow, I can't believe you're treating me this way. What about the culture that we have on staff about being good? And I said, so-and-so, did I cuss at you? No, I didn't cuss at you. I said, did I yell at you? No. I said, did I call you out of your name? No. I said, I didn't berate you, did I? And they were like, well, no. I said, so what part of this am I treating you badly? I said, I'm just straight up telling you, dude, this is not going to work. Now, my tone may be a little stern with you because this is serious, but it was like, well, this and that. And then that person tried to run and tell the story and say, like, I blew up on them and this and that. And anytime you can have witnesses or documentation or evidence, that's always going to be your best friend. And if you have a conversation with that person, if you can have another person there, that's great. If you live in a state where it's one party recording, record all your conversations because then you have evidence.
One other thing that you brought up, and I'm thinking about this too, one thing that you can also use against people who are narcissists is, remember, they think that they're smarter than the average bear. They think that they are smarter than you. They think that they can outsmart you. But at the same time, that could be their ultimate weakness and downfall. That's where evidence does come in. It's kind of funny because, so I know a narcissist who is a boss, and we got him to sign, like, he would give us orders and we'd say, can you put that on paper and sign it? And he wouldn't think about it at the time, because typically the work that we were doing, it might be a few weeks down the road or a few months down the road. And so he wouldn't think about it and go, absolutely, yeah, that's the thing. And a lot of times they're ego driven too. So mainly if their ego is big, they're not going to say no to signing things. They might because they can see it coming down the road. But sometimes they'll go, oh, yeah, no, absolutely, I'll sign it because it's not going to change at all. And then the moment it does, it's like, I got your signature, pal. You remember when you signed this? And before you know it, that diffuses everything. That diffuses everything because Now, literally, you have the evidence. Even if they go to somebody else, you can go, listen, I've got this piece of paper that they signed. This is his signature, right? It's like, so we don't need to play any games. It's all a game. It ain't a big deal. But the biggest thing is to stay calm. They are going for your emotions. They are trying to get after your emotions. They want an emotional reaction. If you get an emotional reaction, it doesn't matter if you're angry, sad, whatever. If you're not even keeled, it's not going to work. And they know that. They've played it so many times to where they know that either somebody's, most of the time, it's they're going to do something so outlandish that people fly off the handle. And that's what's going to prove their point.
Exactly. And that's what I was going to say. I had a situation where something like that happened, and I asked about a certain situation, and they were like, they went back on it, and simply it was through text message, and I simply said, okay, thanks. And I was heated, like in the moment I was heated, but I just said, I know how this person is. If I say anything other than that, they're going to be like, oh, see, he went off the deep end. Da, da, da. I just said, okay, thanks. And I didn't put a period, didn't put anything, nothing for it to misconstrue. And I tell Micah this all the time. It's the Michael Corleone approach. If you ever seen The Godfather.
Yeah.
Because Sonny, who's the eldest, like once something happens, like he's a hothead and he immediately is like reacting out of emotion. And that's what gets him in trouble. And so if you go in guns a-blazing, then that's going to get, but Michael Corleone, he thinks like, okay, all right, you pull one over on me. Okay, I'm going to think and I'm going to have a long-term plan of how I'm going to take the high road and I'm going to get you in the end. And so
yeah.
Stay calm, stay cool. That's the best advice I can give.
You don't reveal too much. A lot of what you say too, it's kind of, when you were saying it earlier, it made me think about it's like, what you say will be used against you in a court of law. It's like, what you say will be used against you in the narcissist court of law here. Like, they will literally persecute you for your words. So you have to be very, very careful. And a lot of times, even if you're planning on, I mean, this is a very drastic thing, but if you say something like, listen, I'm going to sue you for this or da, 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 da. It's like, okay, you just revealed your plan. So now they can counter, and they're very good at countering these things. And so it's like, again, like Chris said, if you just say, okay, a lot of times it throws them off their game because when you take action, they're shocked and taken aback of like, I didn't even know he was mad. I didn't even know he thought any certain type of way. It's like, no, because I didn't show you that, but I've been watching this entire time. And that's how you have to play it is you just, if you know how it is, just keep watching, keep collecting evidence. And when it comes time, make your move.
And that's kind of going back to what we talked about, the big swings, because if they can't control the situation, then they're going to, that frustrates them. And then they're going to act out of emotion. All you have to do is just sit back and watch and be like, okay, they will reveal their hand eventually if you give them time, because they'll either, if they know they can't control you, they will get frustrated and then they will act out of reaction, react out of anger. They'll have those emotional reactions because it's big swings for them. Everything is big swings for them. There's no like, hey, even kill.
And again, they've already made this plan. They've already made this plan. It's just whenever they want to enact it, and when you're not giving them what they need, they say, we need to accelerate the plan is what ends up happening. We need to accelerate the plan.
Yep.
That's exactly
anything else you want to add about narcissism, gaslighting, millennials dealing with that in the workplace, anything like that?
So we talked about last time, and I'm going to kind of full circle it. We talked a lot about your ex-wife, which thank you for being so vulnerable. I know it's not an easy topic. None of these topics are easy. I know that luckily I was there at the end of it. You know, again, we reconvened as friends towards the end of it. And so I'm very happy that I was kind of there towards the end of it. But do you want to talk about, I talked about how I got away from my paternal unit in the first part. Do you want to talk about how and what got you? And I think you did somewhat in the first part too, but do you want to just go in and talk about how you got away from your ex-wife, some of the signs that you saw, which we've already talked somewhat about that, but just how you got out of that situation?
Yeah. So kind of going back to the whole faith thing, I had the belief of if I don't fix this, I'm ruining God's plan for my life. And that was a bad pattern and bad thought process because it was like, hey, God only gives you one person that you're supposed to be matched with for the rest of your life. That's what I believed. And I thought, and I was like, man, I'm messing this up. Like, this means that I'm not a good godly man if like I'm not fighting. And so I fought until the end, until she was like, hey, like, I want divorce papers, all that stuff. But I think a lot of it was getting out of that situation. And I would, anytime I was, because if they can get their hooks back into you, then they can keep you on that chain and reel you in. And so she would change just enough for me to think that she had changed. And I was like, she's making progress, like this and that. Maybe she's changed as a different person, but that's all part of the plan, right? And so then I would see glimpses of when we would get into an argument, she would go back to, yeah, well, remember when you did this like 7-8 years ago? And it was like, hold on. And then it got to a point where, because I wasn't perfect in my first marriage, and I remember sitting down with her and just apologizing for my part. I was like, sorry, I could have been a better husband, this and that. I apologize. And I'd done that probably on at least three occasions. And so kind of coming out, she was like, I wish you would just apologize and own up to what you've done. And she never apologized for her part in it. She always minimized it, her part in it. And she never acted like she did anything wrong. I remember I said, I'm tired of being the one always apologizing. And I said, I've apologized to you multiple times and it's been a genuine apology. And I also said, like, hey, you can't just keep throwing and making this all my fault. Like, this isn't my fault, all my fault. Like, I own up to my part in it, but this isn't all my fault. And I just remember there was never any accountability, none of that. A lot of it did come from like me having the freedom to be able to, hey, if I want to go with my friends to watch a movie, I can go do that and not be questioned about the movie, kind of going back. And this was when I hit like a really low point. I remember going to see a movie with a friend. It was one of my coworkers at work. And he was like, let's go watch a movie, like take your mind off things, whatever. And this is at the point where we were separated, but not fully divorced. And I hadn't moved out of our house yet. And I remember her somehow while I was gone one day, she went to the house and she was the type of person, she went digging through everything. So she dug through my jeans pocket and she found the ticket to the movie. She was like, I can't believe you're watching this movie. You're not a godly man, like this and that. See, this is, I made the right decision and choosing to do this divorce and this and that. And dude, I remember being at work and it was just like, it was accusatory, like just accusatory of everything. I remember like being in the back room, dude. And I broke down. Like, I'm not going to lie to you. I broke down. And I remember one of my friends, Brad, like, dude, he came over and he just gave me a hug, bro. Like, and in that point, like, I broke down. Like, cause it was like, I'm trying to do everything. Like, I'm trying to make this work. Like, I'm trying to do everything right. Like, I'm trying to follow. And like, I am tired of being accused. So I broke down. And, but fast forwarding, I remember being like, hey, like, I'm out of this. Like, we don't have anything where we're shared, but like, still seeing if this will work, whatever, before the divorce goes through. And I remember like just being like, hey, I could play my PlayStation and not get in trouble. Like, I can have internet and watch Netflix and not get in trouble. And so I would get in trouble for, and like, I remember she being like, I will never date a gamer guy because if you play video games, that means that your priority is video games and not me. Because she had a brother-in-law who he played video games like probably 10 hours a week. And I was only playing like, you know how often I play video games.
Right.
Not that often.
And maybe so three nights a week for like an hour or two.
Yeah. So I remember like being in that space and I remember hanging out with my buddy Micah. And I remember being like, it was almost kind of, I was between a rock and a hard place, if that makes sense, where it was like, okay, I have freedom and everything. But then when I go over here and try to make it work, like, it's kind of like, am I willing to give all this up? Like, am I willing to give all this up? And so I remember getting to a really low place. It was COVID, during the time of COVID, like everything. And I was in a depression, dude. And I didn't know, but I said, I need to go see a counselor. I need to go, like, I need help. Like, I, you know, people prayed for me, but I said, I need some serious help. And I remember his name was Josh, and he had a talk with me, and I talked with him, and he looked me in the eye and he said, "You legitimately are a good person." And for some reason, I've been had the belief system of I'm bad. There's something wrong with me. I'm just bad. I'm defective. I need to try to be a better person. But when he looked at me and said, "No, you're already a good person. And here's why you're a good person." Like something in me just clicked. And he said, you don't deserve to have someone who makes you feel like you're a bad person. Like, that's not love. And like, he told me that. He looked at me, and I know there were other people, like Micah told me that, pastors told me that. But like, for some reason, when he said it, it clicked in my mind where like, okay. And he was like, "This is what I see you doing well. And you're doing," and it was like, for the first time in my life, I had someone who wasn't just celebrating the potential of who I could be, but celebrating like who I was as a person, right? And Micah was there along the way and saying, "Yes, dude," but like, I don't know, when you have a therapist who's like a neutral, I'm like, "You're my friend, like you have to say
right."
Hey, but when you have a therapist who they don't, like they know you, but they don't know you that well.
Yeah, and they don't have that bias.
Yeah, I'm an unbiased third party. And he said, "You know what, like, you don't deserve to be treated this way." And because I believed I did, because I was like, you know what? Like, maybe I do deserve to be treated this way. I'm getting everything I deserve. But when he said it, "You don't deserve to be treated this way. And you know what, dude, you're a good person and you deserve someone who is going to let you be who you are, like naturally," because I was able to be myself. Like, and Micah can tell you, I don't know if you could tell, but like I felt like more of myself, right? At once we started becoming friends again, versus before when we had moved to Texas. Can you kind of speak to that? Did you kind of tell the difference?
Dude, it was night and day. No, it was night and day. So how do I put this too? So, you know, Chris lived with us, and when he moved out, the first apartment that he had on his own, he was already dating who was going to be his future ex-wife at that point. And so that control was already there. I mean, you had an apartment on your own by the time, like, I mean, we went to Firehouse Subs the first time that we were like, and I'll be honest with you, and I didn't think we were going to get into this story, but the first time that we reconnected, you know, even like he met me, he was working at a grocery store and I walked into this grocery store and he came up to me. That's already a huge difference than the Christopher of old. He had a confidence about him that I had not seen before. And it was already building to that point. And even going forward, you know, in talking with him, he was already a lot happier. You could tell that he was having that living on his own single guy experience. And even before the internet, before the PlayStation, before all that, I remember what made him happy, and this was kind of one of those things of like, dude, if that's making you happy, like, that's kind of low bar, but like, I'm happy for you. It's like you just got out of prison. But I remember the biggest thing, he was like, "Yeah, I love it. I get to get off of work every night, eat my Chef Boyardee, and watch my box set of Walker, Texas Ranger. Like, I am stinking happy about that." Like, and that was like a freedom to him that was just like he hadn't had before. And because even when he was living with me and in my parental units, like, yeah, we could watch what we wanted, but not really. So it was, and we couldn't really eat what we wanted. So it was, you know, so to that point, it was like he was experiencing that freedom for the first time of like, I can do what I want to do. I pay my own bills. I do. And it's like before he was paying his own bills too, but he was so under that thumb. So yeah, absolutely. It was like a whole different person. Like you were, I almost call it an energy. You were energized, even though like you weren't happy with things. And like most people are, it's like, okay, I want more out of my job. I want more out of this stuff. You were just like happy to be like, I can be myself. I can go home and watch Walker, Texas Ranger and eat my Chef Boyardee and nobody can tell me nothing. Like you were to that point, and that was just a huge difference. Huge.
Yeah. And so that's where I was like, man, like, I can do that. I can go to the movies. I can hang out with whoever. I don't have to worry about who I'm hanging out.
I can go get a Big Mac from McDonald's without old girl asking me who I'm cheating on with at the McDonald's. Like,
I can make jokes and not get in trouble. Like, I can just be me. Like, and I think that's really, I kind of went on a journey of like, who, like, who am I? Like, not yeah. who he told me I was, not what other people have told me I was, but like, who am I? Like, what do I like? What do I love? Like, who am I? I'm still figuring
that
out.
Not for other people, not for other people, because the thing was, and a lot of had to do with our childhood too, but it was, what are other people telling you, or what are other people want from you? And that's, if you're doing well, then that's what you want to be. It was that journey of self-discovery. Now, I got one more question for you, and this is a deep one that might take a few minutes, but you're now remarried to your wonderful wife, love her to death, great situation. I'm very happy for you. It improved drastically, but do you still have some of these narcissism tics? And sometimes you feel like, hey, maybe there's something wrong with me, even though you've come out of that place, that still maybe affect some things in marriage?
Not marriage, because my wife is great and she lets me be who I am. And I got over that pretty quickly with her, because I remember, I'll give you a prime example. I remember her one time I was driving for Uber, and one of the passengers I picked up, she was a female exotic dancer, and I didn't know that. And there was just a regular lady who, she had a gym bag and she was headed to work. We stopped for coffee on the way, headed to work. And I was kind of like, oh, like, of course, I felt like I could be transparent with her. And I remember like having that conversation, like, oh, is she going to be mad? Like this and that. And she thought it was funny. She thought it was hilarious. And so I overcame those things of like, you know, not feeling like I have to hide anything from her. Like I never felt that way, that I had to hide anything from my wife. Even what we're, but there were some things like when we first started dating where I was like, oh, is she going to think this way about me? Or, but it does still come up like in my career, where I'm kind of like and this is something I'm struggling with and working with, like my identity is what I do or how well I perform. And I'm really trying to break that. I haven't broken it yet, but it's a lot of like, hey, if I don't do a good job, I'm going to be in trouble and they hate me. Or I had this recently, my boss texted me, you around? ? And it was like, crap, am I in trouble? And it was like, no, I just wanted to talk to you about this, this, and this. And it was like, oh, okay. And then I remember him being like, hey, do you want to take a walk with me? And I'd be like, crap, like, am I in trouble? And he was like, no, I just have to go pick up this thing across. I just wanted you to walk with me. And it was like, I'm not in trouble. It's like, no, why would you be in trouble? And like, when he says, you want to take a walk with me, my mind's thinking, what am I in trouble for? Or what did I not do right? But he was like, no, I just wanted to take a walk with you. Like, I could take a walk with you. And we're just going the same way. Because I had asked him a question about some, like, hey, how was your workout today? He was like, walk with me. And I was just like, oh, okay. So we just talked about it because he had somewhere to go. And kill two birds with one stone. And so in that facet, yes, I'm still trying to overcome that. But as far as like marriage, no, because my wife has been pretty good about, and she was there with me helping me unlearn a lot of those bad thought patterns about myself. And it doesn't come up in our marriage, but it comes up in my career sometimes, and just like with my job and how I'm wired. And she does talk me through those things and helps me like, hey, no, you're not, like, your identity is not what you do. Like, you are doing a good job. And so she does help me walk through those mindsets. But in that concern, but that's the answer. What about you? Like, do you feel kind of the same way, or is it?
Yeah, no, I struggle. What you're talking about with the career, I absolutely struggle with that. I do, not that it affects our marriage or anything like that, but I do notice that. So say my wife gets overwhelmed by things, or say that we have normal things happen, right? She's not necessarily mad at me. Logically, I know that. Logically, I know like, hey, she's not mad at me. She's mad because the dog knocked all her plants over, or she's mad because she's got this, 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 and this going on, and it's just all stacked up, and she's just overstressed.
Yeah.
And she's just overstimulated and stressed. But the thing is, with coming from a narcissistic home, I had that happen too. And a lot of the kicking the cat, so to speak, happened during those times. And so I still have, and I'm working in therapy about it, but I still do have some of those times. I'm a lot better about it now, to where I can sit there and say, okay, no, she's got this, this, and this going on. It has nothing to do with me. But especially towards the beginning of our relationship, And I think this is because, you know, I went through that journey of self-discovery that you did with her. And we were in a relationship when I was going through that journey of self-discovery of who is Micah and what is Micah like. And so for a lot of the times, it's like if she gets upset, I'm sitting here going, okay, what did I do? What did I do? And it's like, no, you didn't do anything. And that's not a trusted answer. And that wasn't a trusted answer for a long time because I had heard that before. It's nothing you did. It's nothing you did. But then 30 minutes later, it was all everything that you did. It was because you did this, this, and this. And going back to kind of your ex-wife situation and things like that, it would be things from months ago. It'd be things from whatever. It's wherever that focus would turn. And so it was a lot of stress and a lot of anxiety. And there still is some of that stress and anxiety, especially when, and I get that not just from people, not just from my wife, but I get that from people when they go very recluse. So like people at work, if they go very, very internal or what's going on, nothing. And you can't tell what's going on. The automatic assumption that I always have is, oh man, I must've did something. It must be me. And really and truly what it was it's like their kids are having something, their car broke down, they're da-da-da, and they're just stressed. They're overwhelmed. You didn't do anything. And a lot of it is I go through this process of just like it would be of like you did this and you're searching through your mind. I'm searching through my mind of, oh, man, what could I have said? What could I have done that could have made them mad? And so that still happens quite a bit. And so it is a struggle because I do have to push past those feelings and those thoughts and really take it to a logical level of going, listen, even if it is, it's their responsibility to come to you and say, hey, you offended me. You hurt me in this way. You're not up to my standard because of this or whatever. And I'm the kind of person that I know that I will make up for that. But if they're going to withhold that from me, that's not my responsibility. And so I have to think that way, but that's a lot easier said than done a lot of times. So,
yeah, you're exactly right. I think that way was like, oh, so-and-so didn't really talk to me that much today. Maybe they're mad at me. It's like, no, they just had a busy day. It's like, what did I do? Did I make them or did I say something? Or like in the group text, it's like, I said something, but nobody responded. And it's like, oh, maybe I said the wrong thing, or like, I get that. And that's just a journey of healing. And I'm thankful that the Lord did give me such a wonderful wife to where, like, through her, like, I'm healing through those thought patterns and everything. But it doesn't happen overnight. And so if you were, and this is kind of, if we want to tail end it, wrap it up, put a nice bow on it, if you are dealing with narcissism or gaslighting, know, and you're in a healthy relationship now, know that it's okay. Like, and my therapist said it like this, and maybe I shared this 3 weeks ago or 4 weeks ago when we did the episode, but your brain, it has neurons or whatever. And so pathways, it's like a dirt path. If you run a wheelbarrow over that path and you keep running it over there for years and years, you're going to create a ditch. And so in order to unfill that ditch, unfill that pathway and restore it, you're going to have to like cover it up. And it's going to take some years of unlearning some bad patterns. And so don't expect it to happen overnight. And so it is a slow process. It is a slow journey, but know that you can have people around you that will help you through that. And I will say this, don't make the people in your life now pay for the mistakes of people from the past. And so yes, be discerning, be very like, hey, I'm not sure, but at the same time, you can't shut everybody out and be like, well, everyone's a narcissist and everyone has a plan out to get me. That's how a narcissist thinks. So don't think that. You gotta let people in.
And I would say, you know, 95% of the people in life are not narcissists. 95% of the people you come in contact with do not think that way. But if you've come in contact with that, or maybe you're just fresh out, or maybe you're looking to get out, you know, again, the first step is always get away from that situation. If you're out of that situation, but you're still in communications with that person, but you know full on, try as hard as you can to get away from that. And that is way easier said than done. Again, we talked about some other situations like work where there's a boss and things like that. Look for a new job. I know that's not easy, but at the same time, if you're subjected to that, the longer you're subjected to that, the more you will be indoctrinated into that whole thing, and the harder those hooks locked in. One other thing that I'll say I am extremely fascinated. And this is kind of a side thing. I'm extremely fascinated in North Korea and like the people of North Korea. And a lot of it has to do, I always question, why is that over the years? Why is that? And mainly it comes down to one question. Are they actually indoctrinated or do they act that way out of fear? And the reason that I ask that is because I've gone through both. I've gone through both in the narcissistic world. I believed them 100% and I've reacted out of fear to where it's like, ooh, I don't want to mess with this person and they're going to control my life. And so either way, you want to get away from it. You want to get out, and it can be as hard as North Korea to get out of it. Yeah. It's not an easy thing to do. What I'm saying is very, very difficult. But even if you're on the other side and say that you're by yourself, I think that what Chris said is very important. You want to get at least one person in your support net, whether that is a friend, a therapist, a good therapist. There are bad ones out there too. You want to get you a good therapist who is advocating for you, not one of these, well, you know what? You shouldn't have given up on that relationship or you shouldn't have whatever. You need to have one who also has that discernment of, no, you did the right thing and here's why. So, you know, all that to say this, it is not an easy process, but if you're in that situation, try to get out of it. If you're on the other side of that situation, stick to your support net. They will help you out and they will help you out of it. And just like Chris said, even if there is a rut in that, you know, ditch and that sand and that mud, whatever you want to call it, it's going to take you and it's going to take a lot of people with shoveling dirt to fill that up. So it's going to take time. And truly supportive people will be there no matter what. So just remember that.
And the people that are for you, they're going to want to help you cover up that and fill that in. And even if it is out of fear, I was reminded of the scripture that says perfect love casts out all fear. And so people around you that love you, it's going to help you with that fear. But yeah, dude, this was kind of therapeutic for me. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, I know. I feel it right here, man. It was, it's always a great episode, man. Therapy on the Donut Box podcast. We have our own therapy session here, but
we will bill your insurance.
Yes, we'll bill them. Expect that invoice in your mailbox. But no, we had a great episode. Again, go follow us over on the Donut Box Pod. That's DOUGHNUT Box Pod over on YouTube. If you're still listening to us over on Spotify, Apple Music, RSS feed, and then also iHeart. We love you guys. Come check us out on YouTube if you'd like, or continue to listen to us over there. We had a great episode. Really, really good, man. Again, I feel it. But you have anything to add, bro?
No. You said it all. But yeah, I could keep going, but then it's going to be that Southern goodbye. But anyways, yeah, right. I think it's time for the Starship to take us out. I'm Chris.
And I'm Micah.
And this is the Donut Box Podcast.
Looking in your eyes, I see a paradise. This world that I found is too good to be true. Standing here beside you, want so much to give you this love in my heart that I'm feeling for you.